Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath, Debbie Brook, with Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Hi, this is Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. Today is the first day of the month, August 1, 2012. We're going to have Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim come in live on next week's show on August 8th. In the meantime, we're going to be doing a rebroadcast, a really fast-paced one. He talks very quickly, so you'll have to catch it, and it's going to be pretty in-depth. In the meantime, I'd also like to tell you that tomorrow at 1:30 p.m., we're going to be broadcasting live on the Health In show with Elaine Lewis, homeopath. She's famously well-known on the largest website for homeopaths in the world called HPathy. She has an incredible sense of humor. She's brilliant, and she has her own personal way of taking a case using a phenomenal repertory, a way of a questionnaire. And we're going to get into her mind, or maybe she's going to get into our mind, as we speak with her for an hour tomorrow at 1:30, and you'll be going to nissancommunications.com to find that show. We always have a show on Mondays at 11 a.m., which is our live video stream for Homeopathy World Community. In addition, folks who would like to get involved with homeopathy, we have Facebook, Homeopathy World Community. Anyone is able to join and connect with us there. We're also looking for people who love homeopathy and want to help promote it by being an esteemed volunteer on our team and help us get the word out. We'll find a job for you. If you have the time, we have something for you to do to help us. In the meantime, I'm going to be playing the show. And if anybody has any questions, this is one of Dr. Adil's brilliant ways of communicating with us. When people connect, whether you are a physician, a homeopath, or just a person in need of care or just have a question, when you connect with him and send him a message on his website or via homeopathyworldcommunity@gmail.com, he gives an in-depth answer right on the show live for you, and we tailor our shows for you in this way. Go ahead on homeopathyworldcommunity.com and surf to your heart's content. Please tweet on Twitter and share on Facebook and the other social networks all about our shows. Starting now, we're going to rebroadcast this show number 15.
So what we would request from all listeners is that to disseminate this information, to create waves of awareness so that people realize that they can take control of their own health through other means besides regularly taking drugs that keep piling up and up. And, I mean, sometimes people do need them if they have been taking them long term. But if there is any way to get off of taking drugs, homeopathy might be that way. We would like you to share these bits of information, these shows with friends. via the social networks that we have today that are very much available, whether you're on Twitter, on MySpace, on Facebook, any of those different avenues, you can also put the shows right onto your website and share them directly with your friends. So today, kind of an introduction about what we do on the show, plus what we've been doing on the network here on Homeopathy World Community. Today's discussion is supposed to be about infections of the heart. And once he is able to sign in to the show and get some sound going, we can do our regular show. In the meantime, I'd like to just let you know that we have had a recent post from Dr. Kuldip Singh on conium, or if you pronounce it conium, Socrates' Last Drink, all about conium's maculata, and his story about what we learned through the poisoning and the last words of Socrates. It's quite fascinating about poison hemlock and what knowledge we gained from past historians, philosophers, and scientists and people in the medical fields. So you can click that on the front page and visit more about conium and learn how to use it. I'm going to check. Victor Kolaske has been giving us a huge resource list if you're interested in the GMO issue, the genetically modified foods issue. It has been ongoing around the globe in many, many countries, how Monsanto and other pharmaceutical companies have been trying to take over the production of seeds and monopolize the environment in this way. So if you take a look at the front page of homeopathyworldcommunity.com, you will see a notice that says Become Voices and Act for GMO-Free and GEO-Free Life. And he is extremely active, and I'm so proud of him because he's recently published an article about the innovations and what they have been doing in Hungary to create government a good health environment in Hungary, creating the Hungarian Fundamental Law, which focuses on the values of sustainability that provide for future generations. They are a model for the rest of the world, and we should learn a little bit from them. The huge, long resource list and many fabulous videos that are being shown through Victor's webpage right there. Another wonderful, incredibly prolific author on Homeopathy World Community is Dr. Usmani, and he has written a whole series of articles that he calls gleanings, and these are gleanings from the resources, from the Materia Medica, from the rubrics, symptoms, and also from his own personal experience. The most recent article that he has written is under the area of respiration and cough, persons who have asthma and difficulty breathing, dyspnea and apnea. What happens when people wake up at night and cannot catch their breath? And he gives us many, many hints and tips about what homeopathic remedies come into play when we see these particular rubrics in a patient, in ourselves, and how they all are combined. This is the last one, and I will give you a little bit of the listing of the types of articles he has written here. He's done gleanings on ENT, the ear, ear, nose, and throat, the eyes and vision, and the mind section of the Materia Medica, and how we're having delusions and thinkings and fears, and all sorts of ways that people see their world. He has a section on headaches, and one specifically, again, for the ENT section on the nose. He has one on the mouth, and specifically the esophagus. Another one of the articles is on the stomach, another on abdomen, rectum and stool, urinary organs, the urinary system, male sexual matters, and the male genitalia, plus the female system and the female genitalia. Another entire article on pregnancy and lactation, and finally, respiration. If I added all of these up, I'm sure there's some, at least a dozen, very lengthy and thorough reviews of these topic areas. Each week or a couple of times a month, he keeps adding new articles. So I highly recommend going there to take a look at that. We have him on the line.
Thank God.
Thank goodness. Boy, this is a tough day for getting internet connection. I apologize if I made you wait. I went through all of the listings of Dr. Usmani's articles on Homeopathy World Community. They are so incredibly thorough and enlightening. And if anybody wants any tips about different areas of their organs, that's a good place to get that resource.
Okay. And since last time, we are having lots of people asking questions.
Okay.
So could you repeat them?
I don't have them off of the top of my mind in my memory. I actually have had quite a busy day. I have been on meetings since I woke up this morning. I'm very happy to say that I actually remembered our show just about 8 minutes before it began.
Thank God.
So today is one of those days. Today you were going to be talking about infections of the heart, if I recall.
Yeah, I'm talking about.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry. I just found the comments. Is there any written data available on the topic of, and last week's show was eating for your blood type or nutrition for your blood type? And so he was asking whether he could get some more information about that.
Yeah. The person asking was, I believe, Dr. Mir Zahid, right?
Correct.
Yes, there's lot and lot of data available because a lot of research has been going on, especially in Europe and USA. And since a long time, people have been following blood group diets and have been taking benefit. This concept may be new to India and the subcontinent, and you can really get, you can actually Google blood group diets, or else visit a website called www.daadamo.
E-A-D-O?
No, daadamo.com.
D-A-D-O, okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
So,
a lot of material. That doesn't give us anything. I tried it. I must have put it in incorrectly. Okay.
DAMO. Anyway, you can still Google it, and blood group diets are there. The explanation why the diet has been formulated in such a way with each blood group has been given, scientific explanation. But for me, clinically, it was viable. It is viable, and that's why the entire process had to be, the entire lecture had to be taken. Second, Ms. Linda Roach, who works at San Francisco General Hospital, had asked that are there specific dietary reasons why an A-positive blood group type would develop blepharitis, early signs of macular degeneration? That was her question. Well,
right.
Ms. Linda, neither I have in my knowledge nor have I have asked a lot of ophthalmologists who are doing research in India, and they don't seem to know that there is any link between A positive blood type and development of blepharitis or even macular degeneration. So there are no studies conducted, neither have been any papers published. But if you have such studies, then we would like to know about it, because there is basically no correlation. Yes. There is a correlation between O-positive blood group type and gastritis, recurrent acidity or gastritis. But then A-positive blood groups developing blepharitis or early macular degeneration has yet not been documented, at least as per my knowledge. And lastly, someone had asked us that does the blood type diet relate to miasms? these two things are quite different. Blood type diet does not relate to miasms at all. Because they are related to blood types, and how and why are they formulated, it's a totally different ball game. So please don't go into the intricacies of miasms and blood type. It's a totally theoretical subject. Just take the benefits of the diet, and please don't correlate any and everything. So I wouldn't correlate miasms with blood type diet.
I think she was also asking regarding diet and allergies, and we do know that there is a relationship between some people who are allergic to foods.
Yeah, that is there. How do allergies fit in A positive blood group type? Again, there are no studies indicated allergies with A positive blood group type. That is not there. I mean, as per my knowledge, even I tried to find out from the source books, but no relation has been given as per A positive, and the only relation still data have been given is that O positive are more prone for recurrent gastritis, and A positive is more prone for gastric malignancy. But allergies as such have not been documented.
Thank you very much. Okay. So I'm hearing myself echo. That means that there's a button on your website that needs to click off for the sound.
I mean, okay.
Got it?
Now?
Got
it. Is it possible? Yeah, done.
Okay, great. Okay, so now, wait a minute, I'm still hearing my stereo. Okay.
Well.
Okay, so go ahead and get us started with infectious diseases of the heart.
Luckily, I mean, heart is one muscle of the body, which is quite unique in the sense that it is neither a skeletal muscle nor a smooth muscle. The skeletal muscles are all those deltoids and other muscles, whereas smooth muscles are the interstitial muscles. Now, the unique property of the heart is that it works in conjunction. That means it works as a syncytium, as a single cell it works. So the entire heart contracts and relaxes as a single cell. That's very, very important. And because of this property, it never fatigues. Throughout the life, the moment it starts working at the age of, fourth week of intrauterine life, that is a month after one is conceived, till the death, the heart is continuously working. It is one of the very important properties of the heart. And also, this makes it one important feature is heart cells don't multiply. And because of that, heart does not undergo malignant change. There is no malignancy of the heart. But heart tends to suffer from infections. Although very few, but yes, infections are there. Heart tissue is basically composed of three layers. Pericardium, which is outer sac. It actually is not a part of the heart. It's just a sac covering the heart. Myocardium, which is proper muscle of the heart. And an endocardium, that is the inner layer of the heart. Now, infection of the heart can be isolated in a single layer, or it can affect all layers. And when all layers are affected, the technical term is called pancarditis. Pan means spanning the entire heart. Carditis. Card is heart, and itis is inflammation. So any cardiac infection is regarded as a medical emergency. And the infectious agent can be a bacterium, a virus, fungus, or a parasite. Pericarditis, which is the most frequent. The common causes are mechanical injury to the heart, like after a heart attack. Many people are prone to get an infection or pericardial inflammation immediately after a heart attack within 72 hours. And that is called as a Dressler syndrome. It's a very problematic situation because already the patient has been suffering a great deal because of the heart attack. And to top it all, you get this Dressler syndrome and plus a pericardial effusion and pericarditis, a persistent chest pain. And the cardiologist also is now in a dilemma whether it is because of the non-healing infarction or development of an infection in the heart. Then heart surgery, post-heart surgery, pericarditis is very well known, post-pericardiectomy and trauma. As far as infections are concerned, pericarditis is caused by bacteria, virus, particularly HIV. HIV has a predilection for affecting the pericardium. fungal hyphae are rarely known to cause pericarditis, but they do, at least in this era of HIV. Tumors, primary pericardial tumors, extremely rare. You may get metastasis from the lungs, and then still you have got pericarditis. Many connective tissue disorders like rheumatoid arthritis or systemic lupus erythematosus, SLE, which is called sarcoidosis, scleroderma or systemic sclerosis, they do affect pericardium at a later stage. And when that does so, the patient is in a pitiable condition. Metabolic disorders like uremia, hypothyroidism, and drugs like phenytoin and adriamycin. Adriamycin is a drug which is used in malignancy, anti-neoplastic drug, and that is particularly prone to cause pericarditis.
Right. So how when you take this adriamycin, because millions of women have it for breast cancer and stuff, so
yeah.
How much damage is done to the heart, and how many years after can the heart heal itself after damage is created?
Well. Before starting, suppose if I have a patient of carcinoma of breast or leukemia or lymphoma, and if I'm asking him or her to start adriamycin as a therapy, I would have to first see the condition of the heart, then give adriamycin and check it within first 48 hours to say a week. And if I get pericarditis and pericardial effusion, then I have to stop that drug. Initially, in few patients, it's reversible, even after stopping of the drug. In some, it may not be reversible at all. So that's a very dicey situation. But still, of course, few people taking adriamycin get it, but the percentage is quite less. But still, it is a drug where a lot of people are affected. How do I know that? Yeah.
Okay. Well, so there might be a fluid in the lungs or something, but what about the fact of edema that occurs after these types of treatments?
Yeah, I mean, edema does occur. Edema is a secondary phenomenon. Initially, inflammation, the entire membrane, it's a sac. So sac has got two parts, the visceral part, which is touching the heart, and an external part. So in between that, the fluid collects. But initially, there's no fluid collection. It is just the thickening of the pericardial membrane. Once the thickening takes place, the two surfaces of the pericardium, they oppose each other. They come in contact with each other, and slowly and steadily, the fluid starts collecting, and then we call it as not pericarditis, but pericardial effusion. And luckily in homeopathy, we have got medicines for both the states, pericarditis state as well as pericardial effusion. But how do I know that a person is suffering from pericarditis, or how does the person know? And the prominent symptom of pericarditis is a sharp chest pain, which is aggravated on respiration and lying down. It is ameliorated or better when a person leans forward, or at least in sitting position. So, when the chest pain changes according to positions, then one should suspect pericarditis. It is not angina. Angina does not change with positions. Angina can change with exercise or rest, but not with positions. Pericarditis does change with position. It becomes slightly better in sitting position, or at least when the patient is leaning forward. And generally, patients of pericarditis would be sitting that way and leaning forward, so that the pain is slightly less. Otherwise, they continuously get a sharp chest pain. It is on the left side or right side or the center. I mean, it can be anywhere. But generally, it is on the left and center of the chest.
So these are ways that we can recognize that it's not angina that a person is having difficulty with their heart, but that is an inflammation of the heart, pericarditis?
Yeah. It's that. One should... And along with it, if there is fever, either a low-grade fever or a moderate-grade fever, you generally don't get a high-grade fever. You either get a low-grade fever or a moderate-grade fever, or the fever is continuous. I mean, it's not, even after taking drugs, the fever does not subside down. So one should suspect an inflammation of the cardiac tissue, particularly the pericardium.
And this along is with a serious condition.
Yeah, it needs admission. It cannot be treated at home. And along with it, there's rapid or irregular heartbeat. And this occurs before the effusion set space. I mean, before the fluid fills in the pericardium. Before that, you can have. Once the fluid starts filling, the chest pain keeps on decreasing. It becomes dull. It is not sharp and pricky. And it becomes dull. But then the fever then starts rising. And there's persistent pain, dull pain. And breathlessness also then starts. And over a period of time, if it's unchecked, I mean, if I say unchecked, I mean, if you have not treated this pericarditis or pericardial effusion over a period of, say, 1.5 or 2 weeks, then you start getting constrictive pericarditis. That means that pericardium becomes so thick and scarred, so it adheres to the underlying muscle. It constricts the heart and prevents it from contracting normally. And this situation is irreversible. You can't reverse constrictive pericarditis, and it becomes very difficult. Then you have to actually do a surgery with what you call adenolysis. I mean, you lyse the adhesions. So that becomes quite difficult. So you have to actually treat this fast.
So you're saying that there might be an individual who has an infection. It may start slowly, and they might have it walking around for 2 weeks until it gets to a state where it's irreversible?
Yeah. The pain is so characteristic that it is very unlikely that the patient would not go to a doctor. It's for the doctor to identify it fast. Even if you take out an X-ray, simple X-ray chest, it becomes quite difficult. So ultimately, the investigation of choice would be an echocardiogram. An echocardiogram will clearly show pericarditis or an effusion is there, the fluid is filling. A very characteristic picture is seen in echocardiography, and it's very easy to pick up. Once picked up, the treatment is very easy.
Okay, so you're saying there's a good quick treatment for this kind of an infection. And would the person be having difficulty breathing or difficulty exercising and maybe coughing? Would that be included with this infection or not?
If it is tuberculosis pericarditis. Tuberculosis bacteria is the most common cause for causing bacterial pericarditis, at least in this part of India. This part of the world, India and
yes.
Indian subcontinent. But a few other bacteria also cause pericarditis. And if lungs are also involved, then you may have cough. But isolated pericarditis, you don't generally this cough and breathlessness. It is more of a sharp chest pain. But again, isolated pericarditis becomes a very rare phenomenon. It is generally associated with pleural effusion and pleurisy.
Okay, so is pleurisy something that is more common or not?
Yeah, pleurisy is very, very common as compared to pericarditis. Pleurisy is much more common, but it does not stay as pleurisy. It then spreads to its neighbor, that is the heart. Lungs and heart are neighbors. So the infection very freely spreads from the pleura to the pericardium, and then ultimately affects the pericarditis. Recently, last year itself, I had a 32-year-old male. He had consulted us with moderate grade fever, with chills and night sweats and scanty thirst. He had got a typical stabbing type of chest pain involving the left pericardium, left side of chest pain, which was radiating to the front of the chest. And it was aggravated by each breath. This is very characteristic. Along with, he had got breathlessness and a mild cough with mucus expectoration, but no hemoptysis. So all these complaints had already been diagnosed since past 2 months before coming to us. And he was put on anti-tuberculosis medicine. He was diagnosed to have tuberculosis pericarditis. But the moment he was started on anti-cox regimen, anti-cox means anti-TB regimen. It's a 9 months course. So immediately, hardly 2 weeks after, he suddenly developed red macular itchy rash on both the lower limbs and the trunk. So for that, he was given steroids and antihistaminics, but then it was not relieved. So the patient stopped the treatment, allopathic treatment, and he came for homeopathy. He was admitted to us and at our place. And when I saw him, everything else, the pulse, etc., was quite all right. He was emaciated, conscious, but febrile. And we started him on drug Pulsatilla 0/1 because his totality was a Pulsatilla. And that was on 14/10. We had started him on Pulsatilla. We omitted all the anti-tuberculosis drugs. 0/1 we started 2 doses per day. Then we increased the potency on 17th of October to Pulsatilla 0/2. And slowly over a period of 1.5 weeks, the crepitations decreased, the pleural effusion decreased, pericardial effusion also decreased. And within 2 weeks, he was discharged. And it was I was so happy that we could handle this case quite effectively with homeopathy alone. Only Pulsatilla was required.
And are we allowed to ask how it was that you were able to determine Pulsatilla? Is this a good heart remedy?
No, not because it's a specific remedy. His symptoms were of Pulsatilla. I mean, he had got thirstlessness as well as the fever pattern was matching to Pulsatilla. The pain was quite shifting type. And many features. So in repertorization, the symptom totality was of Pulsatilla. And that is why we had given Pulsatilla. It is not a symptomatic remedy that for all pericardial effusion cases or pericarditis cases, you have to give Pulsatilla.
Right. I just wanted to clarify that for listeners that, you know, when we talk each show, this is a study session. We're really learning so much about ourselves, our bodies from your teachings, and that if you are in a situation where you need help, definitely see your physician, see your professional homeopath. Don't try to treat yourself.
No, it's not possible to treat in such cases because one is quite confused. Because a very close differential diagnosis in this case was kali-iodine. Kali-iodine and Pulsatilla were sharing equal marks for this patient when we had repertorized. And ultimately, thank God, we stuck to Pulsatilla. We increased the potency. For the first potency, 0/1 and 0/2, we did not see a very good response. But still, I mean, a bedside discussion with various other doctors, we could then still stick to Pulsatilla. And over a period of 1.5 weeks time, the fever came down. With echocardiography report, we were able to documented evidence-based that the entire pericardial effusion went away, as well as the pericarditis also subsided. And the patient was physically better. His appetite, urine, stool, everything was better. So
we learn a lot about how a homeopath has to have patience and know their remedies and know that this particular one is the correct one. You're saying because the result was not immediate effect, but you kept adjusting the potency or the frequency or something?
Yeah. See, what happens is Pulsatilla, it is a short-acting remedy for this case. Fever aggravated in the evening, which is characteristic of Pulsatilla, evening aggravation. Fever with chills, less thirst, desire for open air, cough plus with mucus, aggravated by lying down, aggravated at night. And Kent remarks that Pulsatilla is very useful in catarrhal thysis. Thysis means tuberculosis. On the page 757 of Kent's Materia Medica, 757, if you want to know specifically. Pulse is very useful in catarrhal thysis, and this was a classical case of catarrhal thysis.
Okay, do cardiologists often have these types of similar, you know, patients that come in with common?
Yes. I mean, pericarditis is quite. It's not something unknown of or unheard of, and we really do have tuberculosis pericarditis is a very frequent phenomenon. And I was talking about Pulsatilla and kali-iode. They resemble each other very, very much. For example, in kali-iodine, the pathological totality of left pleural effusion. So kali-iodine has got left pleural effusion, cough, dyspnea, palpitations, which are aggravated in warm room, exertion, ameliorated by open air, chill with fever, aggravated at night. And kali-iodine follows Pulsatilla very well. And it's a beautiful drug given in Herring's guiding symptom. And if Pulsatilla fails, so much so that if Pulsatilla fails, one should try kali-iodine. So we were about to try kali-iodine, but then in ascending potency, 0/3 itself has paid as rich dividends with Pulsatilla. So we did not need to change the drug.
Mm-hmm. So this is why we need to see an expert who really knows how to evaluate the progress of the disease, of the illness, and how the patient is doing every step of the way. And
yeah, and even you may be a very good doctor, you can select a drug, but then many times it happens that, if the patient is admitted at your hospital and is not responding for 1 day, 2 day, the doctor has a sense of frustration. But then here I would advise that even that patience is imminent. You have to have patience and let your drugs act freely. So have some confidence in your drug as well as your prescription. You may ascend the potency, but don't keep on changing your drugs too fast.
This is wonderful advice. Wonderful advice that you can go up in scale in the potency to activate the drug remedy, the homeopathic remedy, over time. You have to be able to assess exactly if it's working or if it's not working. I guess if the patient is stabilized and not deteriorating, then
exactly. The patient should not deteriorate. But then if the patient has responded even slightly, if the patient is saying, well, doc, before coming to you, my appetite was completely lost. At least now I have eaten half a bowl of rice. That's a positive sign. So instead of getting frustrated, instead of changing remedies very frequently, stick to one remedy, let the remedy act. Probably in some people, the remedies act slightly lately. That can be possible. Or your potency is slightly low, so it is taking much time to act. But then, if physicians are not patient, then they lose the beauty or the miracles of the drug effects. So I would warn that all homeopaths who deal with such cases, or any case, should be patient themselves and convince their patients that let the remedies act, and ultimately they would work.
Do you have personally a time span where you say after 4 days, after 7 days, we're not really seeing much more improvement? At what point do you reevaluate and decide to do something different?
No, evaluation is a continuous process and depends totally upon the case which you're dealing with. It's not possible that in all cases we have a 4 day or 5 day or 7 day evaluation. In acute cases, we have to evaluate hourly basis or for that matter, even daily basis. And sometimes here what happens is group discussion becomes a very important point. And like, I'm so lucky to have a very good group. Sometimes it is really frustrating. The patient's also demanding relief. We know that our remedy is right. We have done the best, but still results are not seen or results are not evident at that time. In such a case, in this case itself, we were thinking of shifting the drug, but at least I was thinking. Why blame others? I was myself thinking of shifting the drug because I had admitted the patient. But then with discussions with other doctors of a group who we meet daily on a bedside discussion, others said no. The patient's appetite had really increased only after 1 dose of Pulsatilla. So they said, instead of changing drug, wait and watch and we'll see. So we waited for 2 days and 2 days were enough to show the effects.
Right.
So your group discussions really matter.
Group discussions are important, and also the fact that you did see some sign of improvement for this person's appetite.
Yeah, but sometimes what happens is your expectations are so much more that your subtle signs also, are missed. So actually they were not missed, but then you want something more. Okay, appetite is increased, so what? Why is not the infection going on? After 2 days, why is the infection not going on? So that's something that goes on. If the patient is not in front of you, he or she is admitted at someplace else or is away at home, then you are not so impatient. But when the patient is 24/7 is in front of you, is admitted in your own hospital, then you have to do something, no?
I agree. Yeah, you want to see some action there. And so, like, if their fever was still continuing on for a number of days,
number of days would be 3-4 days. Had the third day, I wouldn't have seen any response with Pulsatilla. I would have changed the remedy to say Kali Ayur.
Okay. Yeah. So you need to see some action of the drug in order to make a decision what to do next.
Yeah.
Okay. So did you have further?
Yeah. So, it took us 1.5 weeks. So this was in October 2011. and he's still under follow-up. Of course, we have given him Oramett as his drug of because is a constitutional drug. Yeah, constitutional drug is Oramett. So and because all his anti-tuberculosis drugs were stopped, but then what about the disease proper? Pulsatilla has only taken care of the pericarditis and pericardial effusion. But finally, the tuberculosis was taken care of. Tuberculosis has been taken care of with Oramett. We have given him already two doses, one in December and other one in late Jan. And he's still under follow-up. Of course, he'll be there.
And there are, Dr. Adel, there are many discussions on Homeopathy World Community about the prevalence of tuberculosis, how it is recurring and spreading as a contagious disease. So,
well,
go ahead.
If you have got time, I would like to share a very, very beautiful observation which we have made regarding tuberculosis and in India.
Mm-hmm.
In 1974, roughly say in 1974, government of India decided that two diseases could be eradicated, tuberculosis and malaria. It's a very, very welcome move. Yes, why not? But let's not talk about malaria. Let's talk about focus about tuberculosis. So from 1974 to, say, 1978, lots of vaccinations, practically vaccinations was made compulsory in India, that is BCG vaccine. Okay, fine. And every single place, tuberculosis treatment was made free of cost. And the initial tuberculosis treatment was, anti-tubercle treatment was PAS therapy, P-A-S. P-A-S is para-aminosalicylic acid. Now, they are granules. They had to be taken, consumed thrice a day for about 3 months, and your tuberculosis was gone. The disease was gone. So that was the treatment from 74 to, say, 78. And from 74 to 84, a decade, significant number of significant decrease of tuberculosis numbers was noticed. But then tuberculosis was not eradicated. It had come down, but not eradicated. From 84 to 94, people did not have pulmonary tuberculosis. People started complaining of sterility. People started complaining of tubal blockages. People started complaining of renal failure because of tuberculosis. People started complaining of tuberculosis of the spine. So, in spite of BCG being mandatory given at birth, in spite of the PAS therapy being so freely available, the tuberculosis had left its original site of lung and spread to the entire body. So that was, I don't know to call this as a, progress or retardation in, as far as management of disease was concerned. But anyway, it happened.
Okay, so this was part of the government program over the last number of decades in their eradication program.
No, listen, I've yet not finished. This observation
keep,
yet not
keep
finished.
Going.
So 74 to 84, number had decreased, but tuberculosis had changed its site. From lungs, it had gone to extra pulmonary systems, and that is the kidneys were affected, the uterus was affected, the fallopian tubes were affected, the spine was affected, the joints were affected, something unheard of. Now, not only that, number two was PAS therapy could not do anything, could not tackle this. Four drugs need to be introduced. That was INH, rifampicin, streptomycin, and four antibiotics for conquering one single disease. Initially, a single antibiotic could do the job, but now four antibiotics were required. So it was sad. Then from 84 to 94, the sister disease of tuberculosis, that is HIV, was very predominant. And along with it, a new phase of tuberculosis was seen. And that is extrapulmonary tuberculosis, but now we could see tubercular meningitis. And systemic tuberculosis, that means the tuberculosis was found throughout the blood, skin tuberculosis, pericardial effusion, tuberculosis pericarditis, again unheard of, tuberculosis in the intestine, again unheard of. Secondly, what happened was, now these four drugs, along with these four drugs, they had to use steroids. And in addition, initially, in India, sputum AFB, acid-fast bacilli, acid-fast bacillus, tuberculosis bacilli. So we could easily find an AFB in the sputum. But as from 94 to 2004, we have not found, I mean, we don't find live bacteria in the sputum. We find now antigen-antibody phenomena. So the investigation of choice has changed from studying the AFB in the sputum to antigen, tuberculosis antigen in the blood. So the disease from a simple infectious disease has gone down to autoimmune phenomena.
Incredible. So
this has has happened, and from now, say 1974 to 2012, people have deteriorated, the population has deteriorated, tuberculosis is rampant once again. Now the tuberculosis has practically become incurable because it's an autoimmune disease. It is no longer an infectious disease. And it's becoming slow, difficult to conquer tuberculosis. And the drug nowadays has been second line of defense. That is, apart from the four antibiotics, you have steroids, which were unheard of when we were dealing with tuberculosis.
And as a homeopath, how do you approach this? I mean, we have about 8 minutes left to the show. So as a homeopath, you are seeing many people taking these heavy-duty antibiotics and steroids and suppressing their immune system even more. Are you able to address their illness?
Yeah, fortunately.
Maybe we'll do a whole another show on this.
yeah, we have to, because I need to do another show on pregnancy and heart disease, which I was forwarded a message to. Anyway.
Okay.
So, because I've yet to do myocarditis and endocarditis, that is the two other infections of the other layers. But since we are talking about tuberculosis, and what the government thought was quite good, but unfortunately the vaccinations have ultimately led to the state of affairs. So what we need, homeopathy still has got a greater role to play, because we have got our master remedies, they are nosodes. And with nosodes, we can at least control this autoimmune phenomenon.
It's quite in-depth and a complicated issue when a kind of an easy surface illness turns into a blood disease or systemic or a autoimmune illness, which seems to be the word of the day. People who have things like a fibromyalgia and other kinds of autoimmune illnesses, and we keep throwing more drugs, and
basically, the perspective of vaccination has to be seen from this perspective. We have to analyze the vaccinations, because today the child has to have 17 vaccinations, 1-7 vaccinations, 17. It's quite, a good number of vaccinations. And initially, nowadays, we had only these three vaccinations, diphtheria, polio, and tetanus, as well as this BCG. So, but still, we have led a very healthy life. We have no suppression, nothing. So all these things, when we want to implement vaccines, they need to be seen from this view. That's what I was talking about when we were talking about tuberculosis pericarditis. Fortunately, your show has given me a chance to air my views on my observations, not my alone, but many of the physicians in India and pediatricians in India also feel the same way.
Mm-hmm. That they're seeing more increase in the spread of these diseases, not only in adulthood, but you're saying caused by initially the children being vaccinated 17 times. And, you know, in the United States, they're including the boosters, I think it's 60 shots.
My God.
Yes. Can you imagine? 60 shots. And as soon as they're born, they get a shot. They get an injection, which is unheard of.
Yeah, but unheard of, no, it's becoming a common day practice, and it's becoming such a sorry state of affairs. My grandfather at that time, he had got no vaccinations, luckily, in his time. My father also, there were no vaccinations. During my time, only these three vaccinations were there, BCG and DPT, and my children also. So, but I have not been vaccinated. I have been given a homeopathic vaccination, that is nosode, and my children are also not vaccinated, and they have been given their nosode as well. And we all are healthy, by God's grace, till date.
Well, you know, on Thursday we have an entire show we've been doing almost probably close to 2 years with Alan Phillips about the legalities of vaccinations, waivers and exemptions. And we bring up current events every single week about what is happening not only in the United States but around the world concerning vaccinations and the repercussions and the fighting that goes on between the pharmaceutical industry and those who feel they have a right and freedom to do what they wish with their body. And I'm looking forward to hearing more of what you have to say regarding vaccines and the repercussions in toward people's health.
I mean, I'm talking about the Indian scenario. This is the first-hand experience regarding a vaccine. And otherwise, see, if the tools are available, then why is the disease increasing? Why is the disease delving deeper? Why has it gone from infectious state to an autoimmune state? It was initially never an autoimmune phenomena. Steroids were never supposed to be used in tuberculosis or in any infectious disease. Why are they the first drug of choice for tuberculosis today?
I think a lot of the problem is that the medical community does not bridge the relationship between the disease and the effects of the vaccinations. They are trying to break that connection. Do you understand what I'm kind of...
I know that. I don't agree with this point because every single physician, because many, many of our physicians of Nagpur, they are under my treatment. I mean, their children are under my treatment.
Right.
So they, for their own children, they prefer homeopathy.
Well, you're living in a country where it is more pronounced to use homeopathy. It's accepted.
Yeah, agreed. But then still, so that means to say that even people from modern medicine have this view. They know this, but as far as practice comes, it is not practiced. What is not preached, but what is known at least, because people do know. People are questioning. Why vaccines, and if vaccines are there, then why are they not preventing? Why is the disease as such going deeper and deeper? Because ultimately, even pediatricians have to treat such cases, right?
Well, I think we should have a whole conversation about this because I'm getting the reverberation again. The data that they published says that we have eradicated or subdued so many major diseases due to the vaccines, and that's why they're doing massive vaccination programs in many countries of the world.
Well, this is the simplest examination analogy. Tuberculosis and infectious disease, and tuberculosis and autoimmune. Tuberculosis is still there. See, the infectious tuberculosis is less. I agree with that. But what about autoimmune tuberculosis now? The number is growing day by day, and along with HIV, it is playing havoc.
Well, are people making the relationship there? Are they informing the public?
We are informing the public. I, as a homeopath, as at least a physician who is concerned about a citizen, simple citizen, and to my knowledge, at least I share with my patients and give them an opinion that this is what I believe. If you still want to vaccinate your child, it's your wish. But then otherwise, you should think. If you have some concern for your children and for yourselves, one should think about this example. So I keep on giving this example because this is very, very clear. And from 1974 to 2012, we have seen the effects. And India used to lead the world in tuberculosis in 1974 and still lead the world in tuberculosis in 2012. So what's the difference then?
Right. So we need to take a closer look at those statistics, the data, the life of the disease, and what has transpired and the development of it, and really do a show specifically about this. I've extended our time today so we can talk as long as you like a little bit more. Go ahead.
Second, tuberculosis, apart from HIV, has there are different diseases like diabetes. People are taking, for example, long-term steroids in asthma and then suffering from tuberculosis. And people taking long-term steroids for rheumatoid arthritis and then suffering from tuberculosis. So tuberculosis, it's becoming rampant in different forms. So who says tuberculosis is suppressed? I mean, the disease has gone down. It is there. It's very much there. And
well,
we are seeing... the faces of tuberculosis, which we have never seen in the books.
I think that they consider it, well, this is a secondary infection. You know, they will tell us that in order to cure or take care of your disease, whether it is cancer or something else, that they give you these steroids or other antibiotics or heavy-duty drugs in order to make you well from one disease. But then if you get a secondary infection, that's not related to it. And, you know, we can't do...
How is it not related? It has to be related.
That's what they say. You know, it's the same thing for, like, influenza. In reality, people die from pneumonia. They don't die most likely from the influenza itself. It's the secondary.
Exactly. Yeah. I understand totally.
So in the same way, it's not a comprehensive viewpoint and philosophy about health and healing. When I think it's more of a fear-based drama of, well, in order to take care of this disease, we need to do these treatments. But as after effects or side effects, you're going to lose your ability to reproduce. You're going to lose your ability to grow hair. You're going to lose all of these other things that you normally would have.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this concept of vaccination needs to be seen from a wider perspective, and something needs to be done early in all countries. I mean, I can understand such for a few years, we could have understood mass vaccination and all. But the effects are now, the side effects or the ill effects are being seen. Vaccination was basically going to protect us on a long-term basis, but not at the cost of making a simple disease into a complicated one, an infectious disease into an autoimmune one.
Yes. So we need to connect the dots and let other people know that this is what we're seeing, because nobody else is pointing it out to them, just in the general population. It is becoming more well-known, but not enough, because people are afraid for their life. People are afraid of the big C or the autoimmune disease or these things that are happening so prevalently today. So did you want to finish up about the heart diseases today, or would you prefer to do that
no.
in the next show?
No. I have yet not finished. I have not even touched myocarditis, the inflammation and infection of the myocardium and the inflammation and infection of the endocardium. These two topics are, again, quite frequent, and I would like to throw light upon them, as well as answer few more questions of people who have got. I have got from Facebook. Many messages I'm getting, so
awesome.
I need to answer that. So,
okay.
So probably for the next show, that is on 15th, we'll be doing that, continuing
okay.
with the same infections of the heart, and hopefully
excellent.
I get the link on time.
I hope so. Okay, that sounds great. This has been absolutely fascinating and very educational. We're going to have to tell people to listen in and to share all the different ways that we can share today on Facebook. Put it on your Facebook page. Put that link, the URL link there, and it will show up to your friends. Send it to them in an email. Tweet it on Twitter. Put it on your website even. And I encourage folks who are connected with Homeopathy World Community to please go to the page and click on the badge. Put that badge on your website so people know that you are affiliated with Homeopathy World Community. I would like you to know that we're going to probably be doing some new shows coming up in the coming months, and we're going to continue on with our Monday night with Grant Bentley and facial analysis, Thursday with Alan Phillips, Vaccinations and Your Rights, and fabulous Dr. Christina Chambreau, Veterinary Medicine. And we learn a lot from her as well. So tune in, and we will see you next Wednesday at 11 in Eastern United States. And what time is it there, Dr. Otto?
It is 10:30 at night. 10:30
at night. So before bed, this is your send-off to sleep. Okay.
I've yet to have my dinner.
Oh, dear, you better go eat. Okay, thank you so much. We're going to close the show.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.